We have an important announcement to make. We became part of HRN, the only podcast network dedicated to food, beverage in the culinary world. They found us. They saw the things we were doing and they reached out and said, hey, you want to be part of this? And yeah. Did you know about them, Phil? About HRN?
No, I did not. But like after they approached us, I looked into them. It seems to be like a really cool community of people, you know, involved with hospitality and restaurants. So yeah, super happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, for me, it was the same. Like, and then suddenly I started talking mainly with my friends in America that work in the hospitality world. And they all knew it. And when I saw their Instagram account, I had like hundreds of common contacts. So they seem to be very legit, like a nice organization to be part of.
And if you're worried that we're going to be corrupted by the big man, the capitalist world, you know, you don't have to worry. We're going to stay exactly the same. Nothing is going to get censored. Nothing's going to change. We'll do exactly the same content as we have to.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Potluck Food Talks. We're here in San Sebastian, just finishing our road trip. Well, it was not a road trip.
Yeah, kind of a little bit of a road trip. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we visited how many? About 8 restaurants?
Was it that many, yeah?
No, 6.
Six
restaurants.
Yeah, but still, in like 3 days.
Yeah, not bad at all. I can't eat anymore.
No, I'm... It was some of the like most amazing food, but also I have slowly lost the joy of eating.
The joy of life. I think I'll pass for a week after this.
Yeah.
What are we going to talk about?
Let's talk about restaurant openings.
Okay, cool. So restaurant openings.
Restaurant openings.
How many restaurants have you opened from the very beginning?
Like quite a few, actually, which is a bit of a coincidence. And I feel was very fortunate that I've been part of like a lot of opening processes, which just kind of happened, right? I didn't like particularly plan that. But you learn a lot in a restaurant opening. You start to rethink certain things. Because if you're in a restaurant, especially if you start cooking, you're in a restaurant, the kitchen is built, there's a system, there's rituals, everyday processes, and there's somebody who gives you the things that you have to prepare and cook, right? Somebody tells you exactly what to do. Hey, we need these and these, you know, brunoise, we need this and this sauce, etc. This is what you put here, this is what you put there. If you are part of the process of planning a kitchen, even just a kitchen, from scratch, you know, they're like, hey, we have this space here, we have 100 square meters, right? How do you start? Where do you start? And that's really, really interesting. You learn a lot of stuff.
Have you seen this movie, The Founder?
I have not.
But you know which one it is?
I don't think so.
It's with Michael Keaton and it's about the founder of McDonald's.
Oh, I heard about that. It's supposed to be really good.
It's a really good movie, especially for people that are in the process of opening a new restaurant. There is this scene where they draw on a basketball field with the real sizes, like the layout of the kitchen with chalk.
Yeah.
So they draw the whole layout and they start like rehearsing, like, okay, if I go here and just to see the workflows and the spaces and how it works. I think that's a pretty good exercise. I know they did the same with Dos Palillos in Barcelona. I remember seeing back in the days a picture where they prototyped the kitchen with just carton boxes, like the whole bar in real size, so they could step in and this again, like in a basketball field or something, like a basketball court, just to see how much space they have, the altitudes of everything. You know, like I think it's very important to actually do that.
Yeah.
It's not enough. Well, I mean, if it's going to be your restaurant, if it's going to be your baby, you know, like to do that because you're going to live there. You're going to spend lots of hours there.
100%. And when things are set in stone, they're like set in stone usually. It's like very hard to change something once all the surfaces are in there, etc. And the plumbing has to be put in, you know, and you're kind of like, hey, I'm going to put a sink here. It's like, ah, you can't just change that afterwards because you have special plumbing that goes right there. That thing is kind of like what they did in The Bear also, where he's like, you know, there's a little bit comical because he's like, oh, I have to be able to finish a dish in like, what was it, like 10 seconds or something.
So
he's like, and he goes over there, and it's like, okay, that's not like that.
No.
But, but I mean, the idea is there. And I've definitely done that. Like, we've definitely done that, for example, when we opened L'Oréal. We had the space of the kitchen, and we like marked out all the stuff with tape on the floor. Yeah, also to see the space Because you make a drawing and then you see the spaces that are left, if there's like a comfortable workflow also, if an edge is sticking out too much and stuff. And actually, when I came back to Berlin to open this like farm restaurant, we did exactly the same thing. We went into like an empty meeting hall and we took the blueprint and we measured everything out and we taped it all off. And we put tables like that kind of fit there. We kind of like tried to like sketch it off to see if it would make sense or not.
Ah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I've worked in restaurant openings, but in some cases I've come where the kitchen is already built because I wasn't the head chef in that case. And in many cases, I've also experienced like being in a restaurant where I feel like, who was the idiot who designed this kitchen?
Yeah, totally.
Actually, that's pretty much the case in most cases.
Unfortunately, that's so weird, huh? Yeah.
You know, like who thought about this, you know? I always have to think about the case of Los Palillos Berlin, where the walls were this metal that had to be perfectly polished. And it had to be polished like twice a day. And it took like 2 hours from workers to do that every day. So 2 hours polishing walls for nothing.
For nothing, yeah.
Like taking 2 hours away from your workers just to have like a metal wall, yeah, which nobody cares about, you know? Like,
absolutely. And from a restaurateur's point of view, that's wasted money.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that like
psychological energy, like so many things that are wasted with that.
Absolutely.
And I can imagine this designer, you know, these are the kind of architects that then appear in magazines talking about sustainability and eco-design and this and that. You know?
Yeah, it's really easy to talk about sustainability when it's about, you know, I don't know, using the stalks of broccoli. But when you talk about efficiency and, you know, saving time and conserving energy of the people that work there, that is part of sustainability as well. Like, that is actually one of the major parts of the permaculture concept. It's not just about, oh, let's have plants that we don't have to rip out, we don't have to turn over the soil. It's like, how do we design a space where we need the least amount of effort to have the maximum result? Kind of like in judo, you know? And it's super, super easy. And that's why I feel like people, like you notice when people are talking about sustainability from a trendy point of view, because they're like, oh yeah, look, I'm using the cauliflower leaves. Amazing, you know? But then it's kind of like, yeah, but your chefs work 14 hours a day, you know?
Yeah. Like,
so shut the fuck up, you know?
And that's the case, I would say, in most of these places that have like this green star from the Michelin Guide.
Mm-hmm.
I would say most of those places like have this kind of psychological burden for the workers,
100%.
Mistreatment for the workers,
yes,
all these kind of things, and they have like a sustainability award.
Yeah,
you know?
It's so phony. It's so, so phony. It's so superficial also. And it's like cool what you say about the metal, because that's something that I learned when I was in Dubai, is that you need to have things in mind, keep things in mind with a functionality and with a durability. So you saw it there in the... They designed this restaurant beautifully, right? They got this Italian design firm in, and they got the like beautiful colored marble for the floor. They have this like amazing textured, detailed, colorful textiles for the chairs and like beautiful wood for the tables. Everything's super nice. Fast forward 2 years later, right? You could basically redo the restaurant because you have to design a chair with, it has to be beautiful, of course, you know, especially a restaurant that caliber. It has to be super, super beautiful and has to be luxurious. But there's 100 to 300 people walking through that restaurant every day. And every single day, you're open 7 days a week, a hand is going to touch this part of the chair. It's going to pull it back over the floor. It's going to pull it back to the table. People with their like watches and their like diamond rings are going to hit against the table. And if you have only designed everything to look good but not be durable, then you have to invest twice the amount of money that you already spent millions on in the beginning for the beautiful stuff.
And yet again, that's again like a very, very, very common case.
Yeah.
Like that kind of design and that kind of thing that things are not meant to last just to look good. Another example I can think of course, you have to clean, and of course, you have to clean the floor every time. But then there's this case where the kitchen architect comes, or the owner, or someone who has nothing to do with the kitchen operation and says, ah, let's make white floors so it looks cleaner. Well, that doesn't mean...
God.
That doesn't mean it looks cleaner. That means you will have to clean it every 30 seconds, you know? And not you who have this great idea, people that are going to work there.
Yeah.
Because of course you have to clean, but you don't have to clean every 30 seconds, you know, like...
100%. And it's kind of like, and it's like a domino effect. It's sort of like, well, it's not, you who has to clean it, but it's like your workers. And what you don't see is this like ripple effect, almost like a butterfly effect, right? Where kind of like they have to stop what they're doing, they have to quickly do this, it disrupts the flow, which means the quality decreases, which at the end of the day impacts the product that you're putting out to the guests, right? If you're really focused on having the best quality that you can to build your brand, to, you know, position yourself in the market as like something that people want to go to, you want your product to be as good as possible, obviously. But these things, they affect that massively. If your oven only works 50% of the time, or your plancha turns off every 30 seconds by itself because of like a short circuit or whatever, people are going to wait longer, your chefs are going to be stressed out, it's not an organic workflow, and your product, ergo, is going to be worse. And it's kind of like, how can you not think of these things? Because in the end of the day, if you're opening a restaurant, you're the owner and you're the guy who makes the big decisions, that's what you want. Yeah. Another thing that I've recently learned about restaurant design is that the kitchen that I'm currently in, which I'm about to leave again, on the surface, I don't know, have you ever seen the kitchen at Chateau Royal?
Mm.
It's a very nicely designed kitchen. It's very open, beautiful like green tiles on the walls, and very light. You know, everything's stainless steel, sort of center island that goes into the wall. It looks very nice. And everybody that comes into the kitchen is like, oh, it's such a nice kitchen, because it's not like in a like white tiled room with like just stainless steel, no windows and stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's true. It is nice. And I do 100% believe that you have to design spaces to be pleasant and beautiful to be in for everybody to work better. I don't think that you can cook nice food if you're in a fucking cellar in the, like, I do think it makes a big difference if you can see some sunlight. But what people don't see is the functionality of it. So whoever designed that kitchen, I know who designed that kitchen, but that person did not necessarily understand restaurants very well. So what they decided to do is they made the plan, apart from that the plan is super weird, there's like two ovens underneath the, like, you know, like old school French gas ovens underneath the garde-manger. But there's no oven near the grill or the fish section, you know, stuff like that. It's bonkers. Everything they put in, they then sort of sealed off cleanly with stainless steel so that everything is like completely built into the counters, right? That means that you have a surface on the table with a hole where the fryer is in, right? It looks very clean, very smooth with the frying basket. So, okay, what happens, right? Your heat sensor from the fryer breaks. Right, the guy tries to go in, looks at it, and he's like, ah, because the sensor broke, like the cable kind of burned through a little bit, we would have to exchange the whole cable. Not a big deal, but how the fuck do we get the fryer out of here? It's completely welded into the surface. We would have to cut the entire block open and get this like thing out. Same with the dishwash area. They've kind of like, they put a dishwashing machine in, you know, like a hood plate cleaner. And then on the outside, you have the sink, and then they put a metal plate over the sink, around the dishwasher, onto the side, so it's like all clean. It's like, it's good for cleaning, right? But there's a problem with the dishwasher. They have to go to the back cables. Like, what are they going to do? Are they going to flex open this entire thing and pull it out, and then what? And I was like, man, like everything has to be like a Lego block. Everything has to be replaceable. If you have a restaurant that is operating 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, you know, two, three services a day maybe, things are going to get used and things are going to get broken. That's just something that you have to keep in mind. And you have to keep maintaining the engine for the car to drive, right? If you can't take one block out without damaging all the other stuff to replace it, then that's a big problem. And that also keeping in mind, you always have to have a replacement. You can't just have one Thermomix, one Pacojet. You always have to have a replacement item so that when there's a problem, you can just take it out, replace it, get the other one fixed, right? If both break, you're kind of fucked, but then you can look for, you know, plan C. But so you always have a plan B, an emergency solution, because the worst thing that can happen is that like one of your equipment breaks and you're fucked. And then what? You send it in, it takes 2 weeks to repair. What do you do in the meantime? You're going to close the restaurant, you're going to take the things off your menu that you need this machine for. No, that's nuts. And that is something that for somebody who's like not stood in the kitchen for like a long period of time and had to deal with these sorts of things, call the plumber, call the electrician, you know, call the maintenance guy. This is something that you constantly have to deal with. A huge mistake.
Yeah, also something I've seen many, many times is these decisions about how to build a kitchen are taken by, let's say, the owner, the architect that works with the, you know, like these kitchen architects that build kitchens, and they have like this, you know, system where they get stuff done and execute them, but they don't necessarily, well, they're for sure not chefs. They're looking for things to look good, you know,
yeah.
and also to sell their products, you know, like yeah. all their stuff. Another thing that I can think of is building the air extraction. That is mm-hmm. something like, you know, if you're like an independent restaurateur that wants to open a restaurant and you say, okay, I'll get a loan, I'll open my own little restaurant by myself. And so, most of the time, this is something people don't think about, both the air extractor and the fat trap for...
The fat trap, yes.
you know, that both are like, in many cases, more expensive than the whole kitchen.
Yes.
And it's something nobody thinks about because you don't think about these kind of things, you know?
But like, it's one of the most important things. Yeah, yeah.
you know?
My kitchen at the moment has an extraction that does not work, like properly, and it's been an ongoing discussion with the kitchen designer and builder. There's a company that builds kitchens, right? Gastro kitchens. And the extraction has not worked from day one that I started working there. As in, like, you have a grill, you put one steak on it, it starts smoking, right? The kitchen is filling of smoke. You can imagine how it is if you have a busy service or you do an event for 150 people, you know. This is, again, such a ripple effect. It affects everything, you know. How pissed off is your team after like a week of working in a smoky kitchen, you know? Then it's kind of like, what do you do? The extraction is not getting fixed. Are you going to change the menu so you don't have smoky things, you know? Like, that you're not going to use the grill? Like, what the fuck is that? Hmm. That's not what you should be focused on. You should be focused on what technique do I use for the best result that I want to send out into the dining room. Not what technique can I use so my chefs don't get pissed off.
Yeah, also the reason these things happen like this, there's a very clear reason. You have like, let's say, 3 months to open. You have to get all these things solved in 3 months. And then you need to open to start making money. So you don't have so much time to plan or everything. Yeah. It depends on the project, of course.
It depends, yeah.
Yeah, but that's like a realistic time. Sometimes you have 6 months. And sometimes you have 1 year if it's like a big hotel chain or whatever. But these are not like super long times to plan and test and these kind of things.
Yeah, that's another good point. I've, like, without a fail, what I've seen in openings is that, like, okay, take the time, talk to everybody, the owners, the architects, the designers, the suppliers, etc., etc. Take all of that into account, calculate realistically what it's going to take time-wise, and then add 3 months on top of that.
Yeah, because it always takes...
It always takes longer. And you always get fucked over. You think it's like your supplier's going to tell you, hey, the fryer's going to come then and then for sure. Tops 2 weeks more.
Man. What about menu design, concept design for the culinary offer?
Yeah, that is a very... that's very particular, right? It's kind of like, I think you do have to have a certain concept and menu in mind for you to design the kitchen well, because you need to know which section is going to be the busiest, right? Is it going to be the grill? Do you need a big grill? Is a small grill enough? Are you just going to grill the main course, maybe a couple of like vegetables for the starters? Do you need a big tempura fryer, you know? Do you want a big, large counter for cold dishes, you know? Where you can maybe have two people on like a nice, beautiful big counter cutting raw fish and making crudos and like cool salads and whatnot. So like, what's your focus? I think you do have to have that very, very clear before you start, because otherwise you're going to encounter, of course, there's like a lot of things that you can change in the get-go, but you should be as clear as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should have like a direction, like, but I think, again, like a point that is very underestimated is how location determines what you should or shouldn't do.
100%.
I mean, of course, if you make a restaurant in the middle of the countryside and you want it to be like a high-end thing, I guess that, like, in that context, even in that context, you have to do something that makes sense with the location and the kind of audience you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, if it's in a city, one neighborhood will be very different from a different neighborhood. And you have to take into consideration the people that surrounds the restaurant physically.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can do something like, for example, super luxurious in a super non-luxurious location, right? Or or the other way around, you know, like...
Yeah, unless there's like a niche thing for it, like unless you specifically want that vibe and you can like back it up with the marketing and the draw that you say like, hey, I'm going to go to like a really shitty abandoned warehouse and I'm going to make it like, you know, this place 893 by Duke in Berlin. It's like You probably know Alexander, right? It's like this really, outside it's just graffitis. Like you cannot see, it looks like an abandoned house. Inside it's like a super upscale Japanese restaurant with like green marble and stuff like that. It's very cool. And that's the vibe, right? And there's like a doorbell, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just like a little neon sign above the door. If that's, but you know, that's from somebody who has done restaurants for a really long time and he can straight away fill that place and have word of mouth, you know? So yeah, you need to be really, really realistic, you know? It's cool to think like, hey, I'm gonna open this thing. I'm gonna go to the ghetto and open this high-end omakase place because that's cool. It's grungy, it's industrial. But,
yeah, but you also have to think, it also depends on the concept, because of course, if you're making like a 12-seat sushi bar, right? Like where you're going to charge, I don't know, 150, 200 euros per person. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have little staff, just two, three people working because that's what you need for such an operation. That's a thing. So, and in that case, you probably will have like people going to wherever you are in a specific city to have that experience. But if you have like a more, let's say a bistro, like a more mid-level concept, you have to think about where am I placing this? Is there a subway station near? Is there like a big office building near?
Yes.
Is that audience that works there, my public, will they come to my restaurant for lunch or dinner? Will I make 100 people events or weddings or, you know, like this kind of operations as well? Because all of these things determine and change, again, stuff like that you probably haven't thought of, like how big should your dishwasher station be?
100%, yeah.
You know, like if you're going to make events, it should be double as big as you, and you should get like a machine as double as expensive as the one you're thinking of, because those are the things that you think, I can get like a cheap dishwashing machine and that will do the work.
Yeah, know, like, it's the same, no? Yeah. And it's like running the whole day as well, you know? And it's just like, it needs to, like these dishwashing machines, they have power, right? They need to blast. And it's kind of like, I totally agree with you. You have to think about all these things and you have to like think of the workflow also, you know? What I've seen is a lot of people also, what they really forget is kind of like, you look at your blueprints and you're kind of like, okay, I have this and this much space. It's like, all right, cool. Well, like hold your horses and stop imagining your fancy Hosper grill and whatever. Take 20-30% of that space away, straight away, for dishwash area and back of house. Mm-hmm. You need to think, where are people gonna enter? Do people have an exit? And it's kind of like, if they need to have if they have like a no exit thing where they need to go in, say for example, go past the kitchen, enter the back of house area, you know, the back office, walk down a hallway to the dishwash area, leave the dishes, walk that entire way back through the restaurant again, just to be back on the floor, that's not okay. That's, you know, like I had like my front of house guys where I'm right now, they walk up to 50,000 steps every day. That's insane because the restaurant is designed really, really poorly. It's like the very outside of a building block. So if you were in the kitchen, and you want to get to the very end of the restaurant, you have to walk to one corner of the building, to the next corner in a U shape.
Yeah, or you also see stairs, you know, like...
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's heavy. Yeah.
When you have to walk stairs up or down for whatever, for sometimes, yeah, a kitchen in a basement where the service has to go stairs up and down all the time.
That's nuts, yeah.
You know, like, yeah, that's really, really crazy.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, it's so important that you get somebody in that, like, knows what it is like. You know, like what you said earlier, like why is it always owners that like they have this great idea? It's kind of like, did you ever spend like weeks standing in a dishwasher and like washing dishes in a busy service? We've both seen like good dishwashers and bad dishwashers. A good KP is worth, you know, a lot of money. I respect their work a lot because a good KP organizes themselves amazingly, you know? Dirty plates come in all the time. It's like stacking them, organizing them so that you can fill the crates properly, stacks them super efficiently. He has like a flow system. It's a constant flow of organizing things, cleaning things, and then sorting things out, right? And if you don't understand that process, you should not be involved in planning of that area.
So there are two more things we haven't talked about. One of them is utensils, like buying utensils, because that's also like a huge mess.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like...
Huge mess.
Yeah, if you haven't done that, never, it's very difficult to do it from scratch. You know, like, okay, I will need trays and whatever, spatulas and pots and this and that. Up to the very last coffee, teaspoon, and ashtrays, you know, like it's a super long list of shit you need for the moment of the opening. For sure, you will forget some stuff that then you have to buy, you know, I don't know, like a specific size of whisk that was not considered, but that you need for something after the opening, you know, that kind of things will happen. And it's very, again, very easy to underestimate how expensive trays can be.
Oh, yeah. Like, and how many you need.
Exactly, how many you need. Or, again...
Spoons.
Yeah, Tupperwares.
Yeah.
So important to have enough Tupperwares. These are the kind of things that, again, owners, you buy 300 Tupperwares, and after 2 months, you say you need 200 more, and they're like, but why?
Yeah, how is it possible?
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is... Tupperwares is a thing that I believe you will use as many as you have.
Basically. Yeah, because you like the more Tupperware you have, the more prep room you have. And you kind of like, you know, like if you have 20 more, you're sort of like, hey, let's make that pickle that we use, you know, but let's make it for the next 2 weeks, you know, and then you fill a couple up, bam, 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 label them nicely, you have them there. Amazing. Mise en place.
Yeah. And suppliers is the other thing.
Yeah.
That's, again, it has a lot to do with the location you're going to open in a broader sense, like the city or the place you are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how to get the right suppliers, right prices, how to negotiate everything, how to get everything delivered to your place, how to organize that. That's, again, like a very... big issue that requires planning.
Absolutely, because you need to plan your week flow after it also. It's kind of like, well, what fish supply are you using? When are they supplying? You know, when's the best time for them to supply? Do you have a fish production day? For example, my fish supplier, I specifically only work with one who does sustainable fish from sustainable fishing practices. And they only deliver on Wednesdays and Fridays. So my fish days are Wednesdays and Fridays, and the whole hot section fish butchery is planned around Wednesday and Friday, that we know we're not going to do any sauces, we're not going to do any big jobs, we're not going to do any meat prep on Wednesdays and Fridays because all the fish comes in and we need to spend hours prepping that fish.
Yeah, yeah, also a tricky thing is that suppliers will, you will talk to a salesman person. And they will guarantee you that they have the best produce, that there is a Michelin star chef somewhere that works with them, blah, 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 blah. And then you get crappy produce, you know, and that happens again and again and again.
Yeah.
So you have to also actually do a lot of tastings, go to the source, talk with people, see the produce yourself, and do the test kitchen tests to see if the dishes actually work.
Yes, absolutely.
Organize not only a soft opening, but also, I don't know the term in English, and Spanish is marcha blanca, like white march blanc, I don't know. That is, starting the operation 1 week or 10 days ahead with the whole team just to start cooking, start doing prep, doing test services, all these kind of things before the opening.
Absolutely, because you have a certain amount of experience and there's only so and so much that you can plan in your head. But once you see it in action, a lot of other things become clear. The crucial mistake to just like be like, all right, cool, I think this is going to work, let's open. Because you can really damage yourself in the beginning if you're like open to the public.
There's another huge topic around this, which is staff planning.
Oh,
you know, you have your kitchen, you already had all these great ideas that you're going to build it this or that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're thinking, and here I will have the grill person. And you're thinking probably an operation with 15 chefs, 15 waiters. And then you see that you have budget just for 10% of that.
Yep.
You know, and that means your whole idea should be redesigned and rethought. Like the size of the kitchen, the working hours. I remember in restaurant openings, like having already the blueprint of the kitchen and putting like, you know, like playing Risk, like putting the figures of this would be a chef here, this would be a chef here. I would need this or this as minimum staff for the operation to run.
Mm-hmm.
How many shifts, for example? Yesterday we were at Naru, and for me it's really crazy. You saw how many people were in that kitchen.
It was actually nuts. Like I you know, like now, like having also a different view on, you know, staffing and organization and stuff. I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, it's like twice as many chefs as I have in my kitchen. Like, even if I'm doing like 80 covers a night. Yeah.
But also what I told you, that they open 7 days a week, 3 services a day, nobody works more than 8 hours.
Yeah, that's really good. That's
you know,
really good.
But I mean, that's really good, but that's really difficult.
It costs you more money.
No, but it's also difficult even to put that on an Excel sheet, you know, to actually...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Organize that, you know, and the shift changes and the day offs and all, you know, like it's...
Yeah, scheduling is a lot of work.
Yeah, it's not something that is for granted. It's something that requires organization and management and how to... actually accomplish that.
Yeah, people underestimate it. Like, I've seen a lot of people being sort of like, you know, like being decent at cooking and then like kind of stepping up to a role, and then suddenly they should take on responsibilities that are more in the line of like a high level sous chef or a head chef, in my opinion, right? I had a conversation the other day with it's already a few months ago, with somebody who had this question in his head, like, can I step up? I made them a list with responsibilities that I would want a sous chef to have, you know? And it's a fucking list like this long, you know? It's like, and it doesn't mean that you can take yourself out of the kitchen, you know? It doesn't mean that it's like, all right, I'm gonna go to the office, bye, good luck. No, you have to fucking be there, you have to cook, you have to motivate people, you have to quality control, but at the same time, you have to do scheduling, you have to do vacation planning, you have to do performance reviews, you have to do maintenance, you have to, like, all of this shit. You have to do food costing.
Babysitter, psychologist, like...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, exactly. And it's a lot of work. Another thing that people really underestimate is tableware, dishes. Mm. I have seen so many places, and also I'm right now in a place where I look at the plates that I've bought, and I'm like, you've wasted, no kidding, about 4,000 euros. Yeah. Because you've bought in a bunch of shit that's hideous and that nobody needs, that is like not functional, that's just now sitting there, you know? We could have used those 4,000 euros for something else, to buy nice plates, for example, you know, because you can buy nice tableware that doesn't rip you out an arm. But again, it's kind of like, what plates? What plates do I need for that? I like having a variety of plates, you know, I like that. I like the Japanese approach of sort of like different plates, mix and match and stuff. And you don't need to go super crazy with it, but like, if you have 200 plates that are just sitting in a cupboard that you're not using, then it's kind of like, who put in this order? Somebody that didn't know what was happening, obviously.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the wrap up of this whole conversation is that the chef should be involved in the process from the very beginning. And many decisions have to go through the chef, you know, the one that is going to actually be in the operation and execute most of the things.
100%, yeah, 100%. And like, you know, Michael always told me chefs make the best, like, restaurant managers, like the restaurant owners, because they understand all the processes. They understand what a dishwasher needs, because a lot of chefs that I know, like myself included, like, I've spent a lot of time in a dishwash area, you know, and I've spent many services cleaning dishes, and, you know, from the plates to the flow, etc., and like what actually, also the organizational point of view, what things actually take to get done. You can only really have a chef, obviously, if you have a really good restaurant manager or a really good, you know, restaurant owner who comes from the business, there's a lot of things that he'll understand, but there's certain things that only a chef will really understand, for sure.
That's it for this week's episode of Potluck Food Talks. If you like what we're doing, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also find us on Instagram and TikTok as Potluck Food Talks. The show airs every Monday.